Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
The Apostle Paul writes this letter to a new church in Rome. Technically, all the churches were new back then, but this particular church or collection of churches, they're unique because they were not only new, but they already existed before. You know, Paul didn't start this church. It may have predated his own Christianity. And because it was made of people, some problems, some bad habits had become established. So Paul writes this letter to share his inspiration and insights and perspectives with them, and they're going to listen to him. And so toward the end of this letter, we call Romans, he starts talking about the amazing, all-encompassing, nobody-left-out scope of the good news of Christ. He's really pouring on the wow, the amazement in chapter 11. And then he makes this turn in chapter 12, and he says, I appeal, I beg you, therefore, my brothers and sisters, on the basis of or in view of God's mercy, which he's established to this point, to this chapter, that the God's mercy is not a doctrine. It's a real thing. It's far greater than a doctrine. In view of God's mercy, God's kindness, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. Don't present something outside of yourself, something theoretical or intangible. Your real lived life, holy and acceptable to God, which is your reasonable act of worship. Now, maybe that's a bit clunky or a bit lofty. I don't speak the ancient Greek here that this is translated from, but you could render it something like, I'm begging you, my siblings, considering the great mercy and kindness of God, think of your actual life right now as just as holy of a sacrifice that those career priests are placing on the altar in the temple. Your being, as it is right now, is a perfectly reasonable and logical offering for you to make. And then here's the very next line. He says, don't be conformed to this age. Don't be molded by all the stuff around you. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind or thinking. So you can discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. For by the grace given me, Paul says, I say to everyone among you, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but think with sober judgment. Now, sober judgment, of course, leads us to think no less of ourselves than we should either. Sober or humble or thinking or the aware mind, it doesn't see what should or shouldn't be. It sees what is, no higher or lower than what is true. There are so many ways of getting at what Paul is talking about here, this plea he has for a transformation that comes with renewed thinking. What I want to do is I want to focus on one thing. And because I think it's the most important one. That's my bias. Why would I spend all this time preparing for what I think is the third most important takeaway of this text? But based on several conversations I've had in recent months, and then, of course, over the years, I think what follows is super helpful for everything that we're talking about on any Sunday. And so I wanted to take time to talk about it today. This is not something you can metabolize quickly. But it is something that we do together over the long haul. So think for a moment about your earliest years in childhood. When might have been the first time you realized somebody else had something you did not have, or they had the superior version of what you had? When's the first time that happened? Maybe it was a toy that you wanted, but your parents could not be persuaded, and then this kid shows up at school with it. Remember after Christmas break? This parade of prizes, and maybe you did get the thing that you wanted, and then this other kid shows up and he's got the whole set? Or when was the first time you remember noticing that your clothing, your haircut, makeup, if you were allowed to wear it, it was inferior? It was beneath the standards of what children on the playground decided. You didn't have going what you had going. You didn't have going what they did. Maybe it was your shoes. I don't know if that was a thing for you. There was a couple points in my life, man, it was shoes. I'd look at the shoes on another kid's thing and say, well, you've made it. You couldn't possibly have a problem in your life with shoes like that. Literally, you are worth more than me if you're wearing those on your feet. Because, you know, I'm looking at my feet, and I mean, they were fine, but were they beige? They come that way new? It wouldn't have been so bad, but you know how parents sometimes buy shoes that are two sizes too big? Because it's expensive to keep up with a growing foot. So they weren't so bad. It was just they were huge. You know, for the first 6 months wearing them, it looked like my little bird legs were popsicle sticks jammed into hotel soap or something. It was rough. You remember how important your first car was going to be? If you're from a place where that was a thing, you know, you turn 16 and some kids, they inherit a cool car. There was a kid that built this incredible car that was in my class. Another girl, she bought a brand new car off the showroom floor. That blew my mind. That is not how that went for me. I mean, I did all right, but this was just another shoe, right? That's what a car is. It's another big shoe that shows you whether or not you're cool or what you've got going for you, your situation at home, all that stuff. Stay with me here. This isn't about envy or coveting strictly. Neither it is about my lack of gratitude about my parents and how they provided for me and my brother. They did great. They did a lot with very little. But while I have you, let a kid choose his own haircut, please. All these realizations about what you had, what you looked like, you know, the shape of your body, your face, who your family was or wasn't, what do your parents do? All of this was comparison to what others had going for them. And it all had, and 100% has, an ongoing effect of how you see yourself in some really fundamental ways. For most of us, it brought us very early on to think of ourselves by default as deficient, lacking, a sense of my not being what I should be, because clearly others are. They don't lack what I lack, and they are doing better socially or academically or whatever. They are in possession of what is apparently necessary for others to think highly of them, for them to be whole and happy. Their belongings, but then also their physical, their psychological traits, family, economic circumstances, their interests, their beliefs, their conclusions, all of that showed us that we were lacking. And then we became young adults and went to college, or didn't get to go to the college we wanted to for whatever reason, didn't go at all, went directly into the workforce. Whatever it is, we're still being pressured directly and indirectly about this sense of lack. Do better, be better, have better, achieve better, think better, believe better. It's all still there. And we carry it into the rest of adulthood, being reinforced, this deficiency, this lack. It follows us into the next phases of adulthood. You're going to be now worried about adult versions of all the same stuff. What do I look like? What am I wearing? What do I believe? Do I believe the right thing? There's going to be a thing with shoes and cars again. And then if you have kids, you discover an entire new realm of abject deficiency. And frankly, you'll be right back to toys and shoes and cars again. Are you getting for your kid what other parents are getting for their kids? And around we go again. Now, as either the icing on all of this cake or the platter underneath this cake that's being served to us, almost all of us in the U.S. and Western civilization picked up to some degree along the way that there's something more fundamentally and profoundly deficient about us than all of this, because we're deficient in the eyes of God. We didn't just have embarrassing shoes. We made God sad. At a very young age, many of us found that we had apparently disappointed God. Infinitely intelligent, knows everything, but we took God off guard by the time we were sixth graders with the level of our lies, our mean words, our disobeying mom and forgetting and the laziness. And then we get older and you go through puberty and we start having thoughts and dreams and ideas. And now we disgust God and anger God. And there's so much shame piling up. We learned very early, and then over and over and over and over, that we made God so sad, so angry, that we had to convert literally become something else, or else the disappointment of our existence would be held against us forever. That's how bad we were. And this got into us so deeply, we so internalized this stuff, that to this day you might say, oh, I don't believe that stuff anymore. I'm more about gratitude and contentment. I don't play the comparison game. But many of us still have down in our bones a default sense of lack, that we are not what we're supposed to be. It's in our blood. And so all of this comes with us in some form, in some measure, to this very moment. Here we are in a church service where it would be totally reasonable for you to assume that I am going to say, you got to change. I mean, that's a lot of the reason we tune in at all. Change, right? You got to change. Be converted. Be born again into something better, holier, more righteous, more tolerable. It's reasonable for me to assume that you come already fundamentally aware that you need to change, to improve, to fix yourself, to become other than you have been, because you and I have, for our entire lives, been trying to change ourselves. And we're exhausted. Especially because we're not just talking about like the smooth, you know, improving yourself track of maturation. It's just morphing back and forth into all these different things, depending on where we are and various versions of ourselves, depending on these people's expectations and these. It's different at work and home, your partner, school, church for sure. And then you go to your parents' house, there's another version of you. It is exhausting. And eventually it's embittering. So I want to do this today. Let's talk about change, but I want to do it in a way that's far less intuitive, different than you're used to, and frankly, a little hard to take in all at once. Let's acknowledge and accept the idea of you changing or transforming has under its hood very likely an engine that runs on shame. It runs on this haunting, lifelong lie about you fundamentally lacking inside yourself what you need to be correct, to be right. What you need is outside yourself. Other people have it. You don't. Let's acknowledge and accept, best we can recognize, that the concept of change is already baked into us from a very young age in a very uninspired, judgmental, unkind, cruel, burdensome way. Then, let's also acknowledge change isn't evil. And let's accept and acknowledge that in many respects, change is just it's just how it goes. It's inevitable. You and I and the world around us, it's all changing all the time. It's in constant flux. Everything is changing all the time in all kinds of ways. I mean, the reason your house is dusty isn't because somebody brought dust. It's because you are changing. You shed 40,000 skin cells every day. You replace all your skin every month. That's not dust. It's you. You're constantly, we are constantly changing. Our bodies, our lives, all being lived on a constantly changing and evolving planet in an always changing, moving, expanding universe. Change is always happening. It's uncomfortable, but it's always happening. Nothing stays the same. So, you're not the woman I married. Exactly. Time went by. She grew up. The woman you married only exists, if you weren't married this week, in your memory, in a furnace filter from years ago. So acknowledging, accepting that, then let's also acknowledge and accept that the word we're using, change, it describes more than like inevitability. You can't do anything about it. But it also describes you can do something about it. It's the choices, thoughts, and actions that we make. Pursuing change, that's a hugely important part of growing and maturing. We know that. We're supposed to grow in our awareness of ourselves and others, to be more and more considerate of others, more aware that circumstances aren't what they appear to be most of the time, to take more and more risks that lead to increased knowledge, connection with each other, experiences that we can share with others that we would have never experienced if we didn't change our setting and get out of our comfort zone. Change describes healing. Change is the word we would use to describe repenting of hurtfulness so that others could heal. Change is, that's how we describe maturing. That's a path we all want to be on, becoming adults from children. That's good when that happens. It's not good when it doesn't happen. So this is change. This is the good, necessary stuff. And we're going to be about that. We acknowledge and accept that that's part of what we're saying too. Here's the part that's challenging, and it's not semantics, but we use these same words sort of unthinkingly. But in the name of being consistent and honest about reality, we also acknowledge and accept that you and I are not going to change into a different person. That's never going to happen. Now, I know that it might immediately elicit some disagreement in you, especially if you're in like the self-help motivational space somehow. But understand, fundamentally, you and I are the same person we have been the whole ride. The personality we have by kindergarten is essentially who we're always going to be the rest of our lives. We add vocabulary, knowledge, experiences, learning one way to think, and then learning that we should change that, the assumptions it was based on. That's all true. We add to ourselves lots of layers, performative layers that are helpful or useful socially. But we're adding all that stuff to a person God made. That person was made by a very young age. We don't change into different people. We change into more aware people, more aware of who we actually are and who we've always been, but we don't essentially become different things. And not acknowledging and accepting this is why so many of us feel shame, especially in the church. Decades back, I was in a church service, and the preachers, a guy I was friends with, he was explaining that everybody was misunderstanding themselves as Jesus followers. He said, you're all thinking of yourself like Jesus taking a car through a car wash, and then you come out the other side and you're shinier than you used to be. And he's like, no, you went into that car wash, a busted down, beat up, rusted car that you had always been, but you came out the other side a brand new Bentley, a Lamborghini. You are not what you were. You're far more. Everybody's cheering and amening, and I was like, heck yeah, that's good news. I'm different. I have been completely changed, because, I mean, that's really good news for somebody that doesn't like themselves very much, right? Well, a week later, I got angry about something, and I cussed, and it was a good one. And then I said something really mean, probably cruel, to somebody I love. And then I lied and told somebody I was not available to meet them, but I was. In reality, I just didn't want to, because I didn't like them. And I had the sense that, you know, for a Lamborghini, I sure am revving the same old four-cylinder engine from before. And I just all of a sudden had all this shame. And then I had grief, the grief that comes when you realize something you thought was true obviously isn't, which then was fear. And remember, fear makes you hide. I felt like this existential uh-oh. I remember thinking 100% sincerely, oh my God, I am not converted. I'm not changed. I mean, I just said, oh my God. I mean, that's proof. You can't say that. I'm not saved. I'm not one of them. I'm going to have to figure this out, and I'm going to have to do so secretly and pretend until I figure this out. Why? Because I worked at a church. I was in my first year of working for a church. I was a youth pastor. Like, I'm thinking, I'm going to have to start over. I need to go find like a private river to be rebaptized in. This is awful. Like for months, I was in a terrible spot, because it was very clear, I'm the same Steve. It would take years of studying psychology and religion and reflecting to come to understand that that's not what life is. Life is this really messy, chaotic journey of learning and experiencing and taking on some ideas and then shedding bad ideas. But the whole time, it's me becoming more and more, it's you, it's us, becoming more and more aware of who we actually are under all the things we aren't, the things that we pretended to be because we thought we had to for inclusion and love, even with God. So after some time, I could acknowledge and accept that that's not, you know, when a different car exits the car wash, different from the one that entered, what's happened is you should call the police, because at least two cars have been stolen. I mean, that's not how car washes or human development works at all. We don't become different things, but we will pretend to be different things if that's the expectation. What we do is we become more aware. And our not knowing this or acknowledging and accepting this, maybe especially in a church context, it causes so much misery for ourselves and others. So much falseness, which is the root of hypocrisy. So many endless quests for worth, which come, you know, at the expense of friendships. We step on each other's heads, doing great harm to them and ourselves on the off chance of becoming anything other than the disappointment we think that we are, that we learned that we are. So understand, coming to accept ourselves, the who and the what of our actual true selves, it changes everything. From our own actual happiness to the quality of our relationships, our relating to others, how others feel in our presence, to all these different ways that we interact as humans, all the way out to us having far better, far wiser human beings running for elected office, because they're not using us to fill the holes that they think they have in themselves, that if they themselves would just address it with a transformed and renewed thinking and assess themselves soberly, that they'd have everything they needed. I remember when I first started discovering the depths of my own sense of deficiency, the shame, the offness, the wrongness, I was talking to a therapist and I kept using the same metaphor because I was telling him I have these problems that I'm totally willing to admit to, but every time I try to fix them, nothing changes, nothing gets better. I'm trying to become less annoying or more likable or whatever, you know, less angry or whatever it was, right? Nothing's working. So I said, I used this metaphor. I said, I feel like I have a check engine light on my dashboard and I won't ignore it. I am willing to say, fine, let's deal with what's wrong. I am willing to acknowledge and to admit to whatever. I just want to address it to figure out what's wrong with me. But every time I try to fix the problem, there's no improvement. He was so good. And he sits back in his chair and he says, you ever consider the problem might be the light that may be in your car? The issue is that in your system, it's always saying that there's an issue. I think I cried, if not in his office, then at home, maybe both. And to this day, I'm still learning to put tape over that light without saying every time the light shines, it's wrong. There's nothing in me that needs to be addressed, right? It's not that. But in my car, I think it's the light. So I agree with you on the challenge in all this, because to accept and acknowledge that I was never supposed to become a different person because I can't fundamentally, but I am invited to wake up to what was actually already true underneath all that. Look, change is super uncomfortable, but coming to understand that the person I've tried to hide or replace is still there underneath the shame costumes, costumes that I have almost fooled myself into believing is me, that's way more uncomfortable. And so as we acknowledge and accept these things to be true, I want to offer today, here's where real change begins. First, stop trying to change. That's our start. Stop. Because if you have a habit of seeing yourself, thinking of yourself, referring to yourself with shame, judgment, disgust, you can't change yourself. You can only be unkind to yourself. You aren't seeing you. You see a liability to the love and inclusion you want. You see a thing in the way of being happy like other people seem to be. You've thought this since you were a kid. You're not seeing you. You're seeing some sort of deficient, stubborn hindrance to being proud of yourself or God being happy and proud of you. So stop. Stop trying to change. Don't try to change because you're using shame. If you don't understand how you have taken on board since childhood this sense of deficiency, this demand that you be other than what you are or else, then don't try to change yourself. Don't change a single skin cell because you have no idea who you're dealing with. So stop and instead admit to yourself, maybe right now, that in reality, what you've actually been trying to change all these years is other people's opinions. From your personality to your achievements, your appearance, you're trying to change other people's minds. And Paul pled with his brothers and sisters, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Not to be transformed into someone else, and don't transform the mind of someone else. In light of God's kindness, change your mind and assess yourself soberly, accepting yourself as you actually are, since that's the person upon whom God's kindness and acceptance is being poured right now. And if you prefer, long after Paul said it, St. Billy of Joel said, don't go changing to try to please me. So lots of people have been saying it. Don't change anything about yourself apart from the shame and the unkindness that you use to try to change yourself. Accept you. Don't change you. Accept you. God accepts you. So who are you to reject what God accepts? Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to. Accept what God accepts. Now, I know that there's this, well, but God requires us to change, right? Yeah, I mean, God loves us as God finds us. But like the bumper sticker says, God loves us too much to leave us how God found us. So listen, do we believe in unconditional love or not? Because you might not. You might be openly willing to say, I don't believe in unconditional love, which is fine. I don't know. That puts a chasm between us. I don't know how to speak across. But you might not realize that you don't believe in unconditional love. I would submit unconditional love is redundant, conditional love is something else. Let's say you don't change from the person you were when your loving God found you, or you don't change enough. Is there a moment where God will stop loving you, deem you a failed project? Some people believe that. God loves you now, but then on Judgment Day, God's like, well, I tried. Is God's love provisional, probationary? I love you, but you've got 10, 11 years to become something I can tolerate, or I'm going to retract my love. I mean, gosh, I would hate to think my love is like that. Conditional, probationary. I love you, but I love you within this contract that holds that you become something easier for me to love, or I get to bail and still be the good guy, right? Is that love? Is that God's love? I mean, I had classmates in ninth grade who had my back better than that. In view of God's mercy, don't change anything except for the unkind, shaming thinking, the assumption of lack and deficiency that you always bring to yourself. Change only this lens through which you come at you. In view of God's mercy and in the name of kindness, change that and accept what God accepts. Put all that I should be anything other than I am energy into self-acceptance and watch what kindness and peace aimed at you does within you and then from you toward others. Now, people feel the need to counter this oftentimes with, so you're saying if somebody's a murderer, they should just accept themselves. And I don't find these arguments very thoughtful, even if you win the argument with that question. Not because it's just common sense, but more importantly, because we're not talking about harmful actions. You may very well need to feel guilty about some of the things that you've done to people, your harmful actions. You might also notice that Jesus never tells people to stop being who they are, even though he tells people to stop hurting people or doing that which leads to the harm of others. But he doesn't ask that people be other than they are before he loves them, heals them, feeds them, includes them, makes them an apostle. I mean, have you read about Peter? Some behaviors and words are shameful in that they harm other people. I believe shameful actions and ideas, especially from people with power, that harm people, they're worthy of being shamed out loud. But that's another point. We're talking about you accepting you, not us shrugging at harm. Accept you. Take stock of who you actually are, everything, without shame or judgment, what your feelings actually are. Your true feelings, what actually pushes or pulls you, motivates you, your real thoughts, your real opinion, all the things that might be acceptable to others, but you tend to hide because people reject those things. Well, all of it, get your arms around it and accept it as all being part of you. It's all there for a valid reason, every single piece of it. Stand beside the all-knowing, all-seeing Spirit of Christ and accept what Christ accepts and be changed by renewed thinking about you. Free of all the shame and unkindness, but instead compassionately understanding and watch what happens inside you. Because, you know, Paul, he begins the 12th chapter of Romans by imploring his readers to change how they think of themselves in view of God's mercy, then spends the rest of the chapter building on that foundation, talking about love and hospitality and peace and conquering evil, not with evil, but with good. That's why this matters, because who you already are matters. And then you and I seeing that leads to love and peace and kindness for all of us flooding in. So as we wrap up, I want to remind that this is something that we are doing together and it takes time. There's nothing immediate about this. These habits of thought, they took time to instill themselves. So it's going to take a minute to really get our heads around it. But let me see if more immediately I can offer something tangible for our practice, this renewing our thinking of ourselves. Find time this week, today, if you could, and list attributes that you see in yourself. Just put them all in a list. I can be smart. I'm often funny. I can be really generous and thoughtful. I'm honest. I'm trustworthy. Write it all down. And then you're going to notice some things that you have the impulse to ignore or label as negative. Those are going to want to come forward too. All of those go on there too. I hold grudges. I can be defensive. I can be manipulative. Acknowledge, but don't judge it. Observe how you'll want to be judgmental about it, but don't judge it. Just put it all there, all these attributes, because they're all included in what we mean when we say you. Then regardless of the label that you have the temptation to put on it with a judgment, positive or negative or whatever, find a way, when you've got this list, with each attribute to describe how that has served you, because that's why it's that's why it's part of you, because you have at least at one point in your life believed that this attribute would serve you, your desire to be loved and included, respected, all those things, to be well thought of by parents and others. That's why it's there. And so find a way to say, well, this is in me because of it serves me. It serves a purpose. Find a kind, understanding, curious way to find how that attribute has served you, paying attention to your judgments without giving into it. You might say, I can be overly sensitive. That's one I've been wrestling with for the last several years. And guys, it's difficult for us guys to admit to sensitivity unless we're angry. We're allowed to get really rageful. But the rest of it, I got made fun of as a kid. I was an overly sensitive kid. I mean, I got made fun of a lot for that. I can be overly sensitive, and just observe that. That's true. How does that serve? I might say, well, I'm a deep feeler. I can be really emotionally tuned into to other people or to a situation, but I can also be really overwhelmed, emotionally overwhelmed by stuff, less and less as I get older, but it's still there. And I'm going for balance rather than shamefully eliminating some of my emotions. You might write, I can be dishonest. Well, that's because I got the idea early on in life that the only way I could be happy or keep other people happy or get what I needed was to hide some things, to present things a little differently. As I learn not to live by fear or false peace, dishonesty proves to be less and less necessary. I get angry or I get too angry. Well, that's what was modeled for me. And there's plenty to be angry about. My anger is how I show that my heart is invested in what's happening. And yet I'm learning how to put my anger into less destructive, but more meaningful, constructive action. You might write, I'm needy, or I can be manipulative. Don't judge it, observe it. And maybe you would say, I sometimes misuse my persuasiveness as a tool to get people to be there for me because I learned early on, I have this deep fear that people won't come through for me on their own. I have to get them to. And yet as I get older and more aware, I'm seeing that I have resources inside myself that I don't need to try to extract from others. And so now this neediness can become more of a tool for recognizing and understanding other people's needs. I talk too much. I use too many words. You might write that down. This is another one that I personally wrestle with sometimes. I mean, you don't think I'm aware that I've been talking for half an hour? Under stress or pressure, more words give me a sense of clarity or control over what's happening. It gives me the sense I'm being properly understood because I don't want to be misunderstood. But also, I just have a lot of thoughts and feelings about things. And the more I care about it, the more I have to say. That's how I engage with things that matter to me. I mean, you can do this about so many things. It's a simple practice, but it gets you used to seeing yourself more compassionately, not immediately believing these judgments, because those judgments make us go right to disgust and shame, fix, deny, all of that. Just observe it. Observe your judgments and observe them and find the reason that there's a valid reason that that's part of what we mean when we say you. And pay attention to what you're calling an attribute, by the way, because you might notice you have other people's words in your head that you think is an actual attribute of yourself. I'm not attractive. I'm annoying. Those probably aren't your thoughts. You don't find you attractive? That's kind of weird if you think about it. Those are somebody else's opinions or thoughts pretending to be yours. So pay attention to that. That's a good segue to the second layer of this practice. Learn to recognize brain chatter. Your brain never stops. I know I'm projecting a little bit because that's certainly true for me, but one way or another, even if it's not words, it's very rarely words for me, they're very real feelings that bubble up when you're doing or thinking or planning something. These deficient, lacking shame feelings, and that it's got to be real because why else would I be feeling it, right? Learn to recognize all that brain chatter. Because even though it never stops, it doesn't mean that what it's telling you is a fact. And this thing is super easy to recognize when other people are doing it with their mouth. Like if you've got a family member who every time everybody gets together, they go on and on about their, you know, the latest person or coach or referee or their supervisor who's an idiot. Everybody's an idiot. That's their thing. And you start getting the sense that criticizing other people is all they're really good at. But it's obvious it couldn't be the case that they're right every time. It's not as true as they insist. Try noticing your own chatter with this clarity. Observe it for an afternoon or a day. Write it down if you want to. How much chatter about you and your thoughts and your beliefs and your past and your future, your decisions, what other people are probably thinking of you, even though you're in the privacy of your own home. Gently acknowledge and accept that chatter must seem like a useful habit to some part of you. It's there for some reason. But then here's the third practice. Ask yourself, well, what would I say to somebody that I love who was receiving all that critical chatter? I mean, imagine all of that being aimed at a child. Maybe it was. What would you say to that child? You use your name and say that to you. I mean it, use your name. This is so, I don't mean to gender everything, but this I think is especially weird for dudes. You know, it's just not what we're used to. It was super strange for me when I started doing it, but not saying I and me, but using my own name and speaking to myself the way I would speak to somebody who I wanted to make sure felt loved, not criticized all the time, constantly forced to hide or become something else. Use your name and give yourself the gift I know you would give to somebody else who needed it. Speak to yourself as the object of great love because you are. Paul died begging you to know that. Without changing or hiding a thing, you are the object of great love. Speak to yourself that way. Do for you as God does for you and love what is, not what will or should be, what is. You already value love your neighbor as yourself. I know you do. Love yourself as your neighbor. Try that and watch the entire game change. My friends, like I said, this doesn't happen quickly. It's something we do together. I said watch the whole game change, and maybe it's not a game, and it lasts a lot longer than a game, but it does change, and we're in this together. And so for now, may you love you before you change you, so that your loved you can be the one loving your neighbor and the stranger and enemy. Your loved you is who's loving God, doing so with a renewed and healing heart and mind. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.